gentlemen, put your damn hands together for Mr. Eric Hallebaugh. Corey, motherfucking Mac, that guy made a show happen. There was no show happening. All of a sudden, there's a show. Corey, motherfucking Mac. These people are taking black dildos out of their bags. Who's that for? Is that for you? For your dungeon? Are you going to put that in him?
No.
No? He's going to put that in you? No?
Business venture.
Business. That's just a business. So you walk into a dungeon and there's like an axe on the wall, there's handcuffs on the wall, big dildo. I like this place. Wow. Oh, Mistress Genevieve. So if anyone wants that black dildo on their ass, just see Mistress Genevieve.
Where's the business card?
Right here.
Right.
Yeah, baby.
You can take a photograph of it with your iPhone.
I have more of them in my purse.
And then be like, more of them in your purse, and then later on you'd be like, Mistress Genevieve. She's going to hook you up with that super uncomfortable situation. And then later on when you take a poo, you're like, that looks exactly like that black dildo. Because she imprinted your butthole with that shy black dildo. Rearrange your dookies, so now you're just making muffins. They all look the same. They look like a giant black dildo. It's Mistress Genevieve reshaped the colon. Right. Wow. This show is crazy right now. This guy is dressed like a vampire. He's got 19 zippers on his vest. Give a hand for the guy with all sorts of ornaments on his jacket. He's got 19 zippers. He's got chains going from to and fro. Practically a vampire. If he sucks your dick or sucks your blood, you win. Because that guy's jacket's got a lot of fucking accessories. You know that every single high school in Louisiana, their state championship happens where? The Superdome. Can you imagine having a state championship ring on your finger in your prom party limo? The lights are slowly wafting across your face. And then your prom date asks, oh, where'd you get that ring? Oh, the state championship. Oh, well, where was that played? The fucking Superdome. Do you know how much action that ring is gonna see? How much fingering that ring is gonna be doing? Oh, this, yeah, the Mercedes-Benz Superdome. It's gonna be the next noise that you hear. All right, wow. Your son was playing in the Superdome?
No, my high school. We're in the championship.
Your high school? Oh, yeah. You're young. Are you? Do you have a license to get in here? Are you underage?
I do.
All right. You're a super senior? You're a 21-year-old high school senior?
Alumnus.
Whatever. You know, are you still got your eye on those 18-year-olds, high school boys?
Yeah.
You're like, oh, you're the 18-year-old quarterback. That sounds legal. Gobble, gobble. And then his ring is like, go, la, 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 la. And then the circle continues.
I keep getting older and they
keep getting younger.
They keep
exactly.
Saying the same age.
This high school guys keep saying the same. Thank you, Mr. Genevieve. Can you please, we had a good connection. Can you please put a giant black dildo on my ass later? Do you happen to have one? I would love that. I bet that would feel awesome. Smoke pop worship aliens. I've been Eric Hallebaugh. Thank you very much. Corey Mack.
Welcome to Highway Diary. I'm your host, Eric Hallebaugh. With me, Jack Mudd. What's Indeed. Going on?
Oh, not too much. Just
funny running into you again. I just remember back when we were in Monkey Butler together, you left one day going, hey, I'm going Denver.
Yeah.
I'm out of here. I'm out of Los Angeles, and then, you know, you started a restaurant, all this stuff happened. You had an open mic that I was originally supposed to go to, but it's closed down for...
Yeah, we're doing it now. It'll be on Christmas Eve this week, so we're not doing it. But yeah, just kind of weird. About 3 years ago, moved back to Denver. I'm from here originally. And so about 3 years ago, moved back to buy a restaurant from a family friend. So I've been doing that. I ran it directly for the first year and a half or so. Now I have a partner who runs it, and I do some software stuff. I don't know. I have a weird, very weird resume.
So, but yeah, you started an open mic in that place too, and some like pretty legit comics have been coming through.
Yeah. So I'm not the one running it. There's a group of comics who I'm friends with called The Agency. It's four guys who do several shows around town. They do like kind of a sketch and variety and stand-up show on Saturdays. They just started a new one, and then they run their open mic over at my restaurant too. So that's been really cool. Just kind of getting more plugged in with some of the stand-ups around Denver.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done some doing a little bit here and there, but I know those guys through improv. So I've been doing improv at various theaters around town for the past year or 2 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's been really good.
Yeah, we were. I also wanted to meet you at the trampoline place. I love going to trampoline places. And then some of them you go to and it's like a giant warehouse. And there's one called Sky High Sports in Los Angeles and stuff. And it's like a huge warehouse. You go to trampoline. And then there, I was like, oh, let's meet at this trampoline place called like Fun Zone here in Denver. And like, it was basically all little kids and me walking in with beard, you know, it's like,
yeah, guys who look like us, you know, balding with the beard. You're sort of restricted in some of the places.
Yeah, you can own a motorcycle and they'll give you a deal. But like, if you walk into like a little kiddie trampoline place, you might get arrested.
Yeah, I'm not super welcome around like playgrounds and stuff. I mean, legally I am, and I'm not a bad guy. I'd never hurt a kid, but
it's just
you get looks.
You know, it's like a pit bull. Is every pit bull bad? No, but you know, you get some of them that bite someone's face off every now and then they're on the news getting a face transplant.
Yeah, exactly. That's white guys in their late 20s and 30s who are bald and have facial hair.
Yeah, you're in a category of high risk for sure. So are you, what are your goals here with comedy in Denver? And what's the scene like here?
Yeah, so... The scene in Denver is actually really good. It's a super strong scene, and it's just been really growing for the past couple years. We've got, you know, some of the more established comics from the scene and stuff. One group just sold, they made a pilot for Amazon, and it didn't get picked up, but then True TV picked it up. So they've just released a show, and that's got, like, three of the comics from the scene. It's called Those Who Can't, and they're playing like high school teachers. It's actually super funny. So there's kind of like there's a good scene here. There's the Comedy Works downtown has been around for forever, and it's like we get, I think geographically and because of that club, we get like all the national, all touring comics and stuff. Like I think that's like Dave Chappelle is. Played that club literally dozens and dozens and dozens of times. Like he'll come and he'll just do four or five nights there, and I saw him there a couple months ago, and he dropped in and like hosted a new talent night, just kind of doing it, and then he had a show at Red Rocks the next day, so like a 8,000 seat venue. So there's definitely been a long established kind of comedy scene in Denver. But lately, it's just, like, blowing up. There's so many mics. You can go to 3-4 open mics a night if you want. There's a lot of good showcases. All these different places are starting to actually have comedy nights, you know, bars and a lot of the breweries. So it's just, it's a really growing scene. But the really cool thing, because I'm more involved in, like, the improv scene here. The really cool thing is it's, like, there's a lot of really talented people here. And a lot of people who have trained in Chicago, New York, LA, and stuff. But the scene is growing, and there's enough stage time for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels really, really, like, collaborative, super supportive. You know, there's now, like, 3-4 different places that are, like, exclusively improv.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, a lot more that are doing stand-up. So it's just been, like, I don't know. It's a very, very different from the scene in LA that I was used to. And I actually just, I really, really like it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like because maybe the industry is, like, farther away, then it's more of, like, the purest thing. It's not like we're all doing something to get famous. Everyone's just kind of, like, using it as a college to help each other get better.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, like, in LA, I mean, we were both in the improv scene in LA and everything. That's where we met. But it's, you know, people there are hustling for work. They're hustling to get their SNL shot. They're hustling to get on a sitcom or that. And not to say that people don't have those goals here, but there, I just have it feels to me, and this could just be me talking. It feels like out there, like there's more competition in that if someone's doing good, you know, that means that someone else can't be doing good. And so, right, right. like it's a fixed pie kind of, and it's, and same with, you know, stand up and stuff like that, where it's like there's a lot more competition versus out here. People still, you know, people still have goals and want to do this and that and everything. But here there's not that sense of if one person's doing good, it means someone else isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Here it's more like, if the scene is doing good, everyone's doing good. So there's been just, I have a real feeling of like, there's a lot more camaraderie.
Yeah. And also it's like, if you do a comedy show and then someone like does terrible in front of you and then you do great, it's not like, oh, thank God I saved the show. It's like, no, as a whole, that show was worse. And so maybe the audience won't come back anymore. So right. it's like we kind of like rise or fall together type of thing. So we can't, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's like the biggest thing for me. So I'm planning on moving back to Los Angeles, or at least living there and spending time in both cities. You know, because I have my business here and I have a lot of friends here and everything. But for me, I want to write TV. I want to do creative stuff that I would need to be there. And I also have just a stronger network of making that a reality. I have a stronger network in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it's like, I plan on still keeping a foot in this scene pretty much as long as I'm able to.
Right.
Because it's, you know, it's still just so supportive and there's so many cool, talented people, you know, doing really interesting things too. You know, the other thing that's nice is like out in LA or Chicago or wherever, even with like improv, you know, there's a lot of competition to get on like a house team or to, you know, to be on a main stage team at UCB or IO or wherever. And here, you know, there, it's still, you know, that's still a thing where it's like, you want to be on a main stage team. And I'm on a team that performs Wednesdays, and then I'm on various other teams and jump on different shows and stuff like that. But there's not this like massive competition for stage time. So if you want to produce your own show, like if you want to just do something because you want to try it, or, you know, you've got an independent team and you're like looking for stage time, you can do that. You know, it's really nice in that, you know, there's not this huge competition just to get on. Not to say that, you know, there's not a lot of talent here or anything, but it's like there's enough stage time between all the theaters and all the places where you can perform that if you want to do something, you can. You don't have to wait for
approval.
Yeah, there's not gatekeepers as much here. Like, pretty much if you want to do something, you can do it.
So let's say, like, the hottest team in town, like, you also did a show, like, Fridays at 8. Would that team be, like, furious at you that you were stealing their time? And shouldn't you coordinate the mics better so that everyone has different times?
No, really.
So there's a scarcity of audience.
You know, there is. And that's one of the things is that, you know, we don't have the built-in audience like at UCB in LA or something. You know, it's like the majority of their shows sell out. You go there and you don't really have to promote if you're on a team. People are going to come just for the venue. We don't fully have that. So, you still do have to kind of hustle and promote. And, I mean, I've done sets for 5 people and I've done sets for 150 or whatever. And there's not the built-in audience that you have in more established scenes or established cities. But, I mean, there's several theaters and most people have kind of their home theater, but perform at all of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I've performed at, you know, pretty much any of the theaters around town. And, you know, there's the Friday at 8 show at this theater, and then there's the Friday at 8 show at another one. Chances are you've performed in a show with those people somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you know them from around. We just had the Denver Improv Festival like last month. And so I performed in that and then went and watched a bunch of the shows too. And, you know, everyone's pretty much friendly and friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a really tight community outside of just the shows where people are hanging out, people are getting together on the weekends, you know, hanging out backstage, whatever it is. And so you have, I mean, any show that would be like, quote, competition, I probably have 2 or 3 friends who are in it.
Right.
So there's not nearly as much like.
And then why are you mad at Scott or Sam for doing exactly what you want to do?
Yeah, there's never any of that. I've never gotten that feeling of like, oh, they're doing this or they're doing that. It's more just like.
Great, awesome. There's more shows.
Yeah.
And if they're good and they train and then they come on my show and they're better because they also perform that night, great.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And, you know, one thing, and this is also maybe my perception is, I mean, I've been doing improv for a pretty long time, like not straight through, but I started like 13, 14 years ago is when I first started doing improv. And there's so many more females in the scene here, which for me, I'm way happy about. I mean, mm-hmm. We were on a team together in LA and it's like, oh, look, 8 white dudes in their 20s.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And here it feels like there's a lot more diversity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot more women who are performing. There's not really that kind of like boys club feel,
mm-hmm.
at least for improv, you know, stand up. I think anywhere there's kind of a little bit of a boys club type thing, but you know, I'm on a team, you know, with a guy who's in his 50s and it's, and you know, people anywhere from their early 20s through their 50s, men, women. And so it gives like, I don't know. I like the different perspectives. I see enough, you know, white guys in their 20s doing comedy.
But then if the guy in his 50s is like the CEO of a company in a scene, he's like, listen, then you just buy it more. Because like, yeah, if he was like the senior partner, he would be an older guy. And then he's got his young lawyers or whatever kind of scene you're trying to make. It's like, yeah. You want to cast a different people.
And that's the nice thing, too, is it just brings more more interesting kind of dynamics and stuff.
Yeah. Or if he's got to be the daughter in the next scene.
Yeah.
And that's what he's fucking doing. So yeah. He's going to play the best, you know, 12-year-old girl he can.
And I just, I mean, for me personally, that's something I'm pretty, pretty passionate about is like, I think the whole, like, are women funny? I think it's such a fucking lazy, like,
mm-hmm.
thought process.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing too, is it's like, I don't know, for me personally, I'm like, okay, well, even if, you know, men are naturally funny or whatever it is, when there's some barrier in your thinking, well, a woman's not going to be funny. You're just getting rid of, like, and discouraging half of the potential artists, people who generate right. content. You know,
scene partners.
Scene partners, everything. Like,
yeah.
I don't want to live in a world where, you know, where Tina Fey isn't allowed to make TV shows because she's one of the funniest people on the planet.
Right.
And it's like, if you have this, what in my mind, lazy thought process of like, no, guys are just more funny, then you're losing out on how many hundreds of potentially incredible albums or TV shows or stand-up specials.
I don't think
specials.
Anyone's saying women shouldn't do comedy really anymore.
Yeah,
know?
Well, I mean, I think not a lot of the younger kind of generations, but
right.
the fact that that's still in, I mean, you can read it online on in lots of places that there's still some sort of like debate. And even if it's people not saying women shouldn't do comedy, but if it's really unfriendly or it's they're having a hard time getting on shows or
right.
just having the
I just don't want to bomb. I just think, you know, I don't want to bomb. And if I see behind the scenes where I'm always, you know, dealing with the same person over and over again and they can, like, catch the balls that I'm throwing and throw them
oh,
back
yeah.
and, like, still have the game going, that's it. That's
yeah.
how, like, I just can't have stupid people. When people are slow or they're always forgetting stuff from the scene, like if we're supposed to be in a law firm and then later on they're like, oh, this is a real estate. You know,
right, yeah,
that's
yeah,
a
yeah.
huge thing that I cannot have happen, you know? So they just, if their memory is good and they're sharp and they can, like, juggle different details over and over, then who cares, you know?
Oh, yeah.
That's it.
That's absolutely. That's how I feel.
So we were talking a little bit off mic about you're making a lot of changes in your life, you know? You were doing good, making money, doing the whole corporate thing, but you weren't doing enough art, and it's hard to, like, continue to do comedy while you also have to, you know, do good professionally.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's like a the biggest thing that's been going on in my life is just kind of trying to reconcile those. And so, like, for me, really, I started doing improv when I was 14, you know, in high school, and did it all in high school. I've always kind of like to make things. I make a lot of stuff with my hands. I like to make stuff out of leather and sew and all kinds of weird stuff. But, like, for me, previously, I always thought of myself as just kind of like, you know, a normal businessman kind of guy who just happens to have these creative hobbies. And it was miserable. Like, I was doing a lot of stuff with my life because it's what I thought that I should do and what I was kind of good at. So I was working in advertising when we knew each other in Los Angeles, and I was doing improv on the side, but it wasn't something I was pursuing. It was just because I like to create things. And then I came back here to own a restaurant, and I've done that, and then started doing another job too, working in software for a bank, and I've done pretty well with that. But all of that stuff is just other people's concept of success, and, you know, I was super depressed. I mean, well, that's been a thing my whole life, but it was like I really looked like my life was, like, going really good. You know, my parents could tell their friends stuff about me and, like, oh, you know, I've got this job and I've got my business and all this. And it's just, like, it was so, like, miserable just doing other people's idea of what my life should look like. And I don't know. And that's when I just kind of, I came to the core realization that, like, all that type of shit and, like, chasing money and chasing, quote, success and that sort of stuff, just wasn't, that's not who I am. Like, I kind of came to the realization that at my very core, I'm an artist or someone who has to create, and I just happen to also be interested in, you know, business and that sort of stuff. But just realizing that I'm an artist or a creative person who's interested in the business world, as opposed to a business world typical person who's interested in the art world. It sounds like a pretty small thing, but like that change, which happened probably about a year or 15 months ago, has been like the most significant change in my life. Just realizing, like, I don't know, more about myself, and it kind of explains a lot of my like ways I was dissatisfied in my life and unhappy and stuff.
Well, I mean, it's really tough to do show business, because then you also feel like, oh, well, if I can get a TV show on Hulu or Netflix or any of these places, that's the end of the line. But, I mean, a lot of those people do that. They get a few seasons, and then it's like they're used to getting money from that, and they kind of put all their... And then after that ends, like, you know, what really tripped me out is Dave Foley on the Joe Rogan podcast saying that his divorce bankrupted him. And then I'm thinking, like, oh, shit. Like, the whole time I'm thinking, oh, well, if I just get a TV show, then I'll be set for life. And it's just the reality is that's not true. So, like, what are you doing, really, just to survive, you know? This world is, you know, tough. It's almost like Los Angeles. It's, like, it's so tough there because there's so many people trying to do the same exact thing that you kind of get overwhelmed by, just feeling like another salmon, like banging his head against the wall. You know what I mean? So.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's one area for me. I've been pretty fortunate in that. My brother, who you also know, my brother, he's made his living as a musician for 10 years or so now. Mm-hmm. And so it's been really nice for me just kind of being able to see how that sort of thing can work, because it's true. I mean, you know, someone gets their show or they get their movie or whatever, and I think the natural inclination is to assume that things are always going to be as good or better now. But, you know, then you have a couple bad years, or, you know, your show gets canceled or this or that, and it's like, and it's still a struggle. So for me, being able to see, like, with my brother, how he's managed to, you know, make his living and work in the creative fields while still, like, you know, making sure he can continue to do it, you know, not having to stop and
so what changes, get another job. What huge changes did you make in this time period? And then what huge changes are you going to make in the future? What's going on?
Yeah. So, I mean... Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, my natural inclination is to be really private and really kind of closed off. And so I've just like I never would have talked about, like, you know, had this type of conversation 2 years ago, or talked about, you know, some of my like mental illness problems. You know, like I've a couple different types of depression that are really, really huge parts of my life, and that literally no one knew about for the first 12 years or something. Mm-hmm. You know, I was, my inclination would be like to be self-reliant and just not share things with people. And so just being a lot more open about that sort of stuff and trying to get that type of thing under control. Yeah. So that, and then, I mean, I smoked weed for the first time when I was 25.
Me too.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Which is funny. Like, it's funny because I waited until it was legal in Colorado and then still smoked weed for the first time in New York where it was illegal. but I don't know, just, and that's been something where it's like, oh, this is a really like positive thing that helps me with depression, with anxiety. I kind of overthink things and my brain's always going a million miles a minute. And so just letting me kind of like calm down and just really just be more in the moment. Mm-hmm. That's been a really big thing for me. So now I actually, I'm a, I'm, well, I guess medical user or whatever, but it's like, now, like, weed is a relatively big part of my life in that it's really helpful for me mentally. It's really nice socially, especially being in Denver. No one really gives a shit. Mm-hmm. I mean, we sit on the front porch of the club after a show and smoke weed and drink beer. And
are you allowed to smoke weed outside on the streets in Denver?
Not technically. Technically, the only place you can legally smoke weed is in your like backyard or your own property or someone's property with their permission. So technically, you like can't smoke it in your apartment or whatever, but effectively, as long as you're not being an asshole, they don't really care mm-hmm. what you do.
Right.
And well, part of it too is me being like a white male, and not really being afraid of
authority.
Yeah. I mean,
if you just look like you know what you're doing.
I'll smoke a joint walking down the street or, you know, bring my vaporizer to a concert or whatever. And really it's like, it's pretty much not a big deal at all. In Denver, it depends. Like there's some cities that still don't have it legalized for like recreational and stuff. The way the law was written is kind of weird, but so there's places you can go where it's a bigger deal, but, it's not like an issue at all now, which is really how the fuck it should be.
I also just think most people are just into their own head anyway. And if you're paranoid that like, oh, are they going to catch me here? That's really in your own head. It's like some lady is walking by you is not thinking, oh, you're smoking a joint. You shouldn't be doing that. She's thinking, oh, I just threw out a battery. Was I allowed to do that? Am I going to pollute the lake?
Yeah.
Everyone's got their own, like, thing that they're worried about. If they're
that's also just true, like, in life. Yeah. I feel like so many people are worried what other people think about them or are
But that's what everyone is doing.
Yeah, and
so
it's like
nobody really cares about what anyone is doing.
Yeah, and that's my thing, too, is it's just, like, I just kind of moved more and more towards just like not giving a shit.
Yeah.
And like even with like my I never would have used my like actual name on any stuff like this because I was still kind of corporate focused.
Right.
So like I used to do self-indulgent podcast a fair amount, and I would never use my full name first and last because I'm like I didn't want it to be in my online kind of footprint, right, any of right. that type of stuff. And now just like being like giving a whole lot less of a shit about that, and just like now I'm just like, you know what, I'm gonna live my life the way I want to, and I'm aware that there's consequences. You know, I'm aware that conceivably my employer at this, you know, large corporate bank could find stuff and drug test me and fire me or whatever, but it's like if that happens, I'll land on my feet.
Let me tell you exactly what your employer at your corporate bank is doing right now. He's like got like fucking four side pussies, right? And he's like trying to juggle them so that they don't know about each other. And also his wife.
Oh, no,
you know,
I work.
Doesn't have anything else to tell her lawyer for more alimony. So, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Everyone's throwing out batteries and going, can I do this? You know?
Oh, yeah. And it really sounds like such a minor thing. Like, none of my stuff sounds all that drastic or anything, you know. But
yeah, I think what you're saying is before you found protection in privacy, and now you find protection in being open, because you realize it's like once you say it, nobody can accuse you of anything that you've already said.
Yeah, and even with my parents and stuff, you know, just letting them know, you know, I kind of had this conversation with them where I was like, hey, just so you guys know, like this is kind of what I'm doing, and I'm not really like super close with my family in general, but I was like, hey, so this is what I'm doing. I'm pursuing trying to do comedy and writing as a living. I'm trying to transition, so that's what I do. And also, you guys are gonna hate like 95% of my work,
right?
Because I'm very very different from my parents. They're conservative Christians, that sort of thing, and I'm just like, you know, like, I don't need to censor myself. I don't need to hide any of this stuff. But just so you're aware, you can come and see my shows, or you can come and see stuff if you would like to, but you're going to hate the majority of it.
Right, right.
And that's fine. Like, you can deal with that or whatever. And same with, you know, people who, friends, I have a lot of friends who have different political views or different whatever views. And it's like, honestly, I find a lot of things just kind of ridiculous. Like, I think there's so much ridiculous with, like, Christianity and the political systems and all that stuff. And now, rather than just internalizing it, I'm engaging more or less afraid to speak my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm good, you know, I'm fine with me. If I didn't think I was, you know, a good person or doing the right thing, then I would change it. So I don't particularly give a shit about other people's opinions anymore. You know, friends, parents who might hear some of my material or see something right. I've written and think yeah. like, oh, it's like, no, I was always the same person. Now you're just seeing it rather than.
Yeah. See, I'm like so dogmatic as far as like. When I see comedy, I really don't even judge any of the experiences. I'm just looking at the writing, the joke writing. How are they revealing this information in a way where it's like, you know, for what, you know, it just everyone has a different point of view. And so they're scandalized at different levels.
Yeah.
And it's like if you can point to your own experience going through life and learning different pieces of information where you had revelations and you know what I mean? That's your experience, and that's kind of bulletproof, because, no, it's like, no, I was looking through these eyes, and from these eyes it looked like this, you know? I don't know what I'm saying.
No, no, and that's something I've been really trying to do, too, is, like, I really, now that I'm just kind of more embracing my true self or whatever it is, I'm a very empathetic person, and so I actually, part of the reason I like comedy so much, like, specifically stand-up, is that that's about as, like, one person's point of view. That's almost, like, as pure inside someone's head as you can go.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for some reason, I think stand-up comedy and rap are, like, the two things where you're getting the most, like, pure, unfiltered view of someone's headspace.
Mm-hmm.
So I love that. I love to people who I don't agree with or people who have very different experiences, I seek that out now, because mm-hmm. it's like, I want to, you know, I coming to terms with the yeah. fact that, like, me as a straight white male, like, I have one set of experiences that is very different from a lot of other people's experiences. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I used to be more, like, I grew up, I have seven older siblings. Neither of my parents went to college. Like, when I was very young, we were very poor. Like, actually poor. Then we kind of, as kids grew up and moved out, my parents started doing better and stuff. We moved into, like, the middle class or whatever. But I always had a chip on my shoulder because I went to, like, I was the poorest of my friends in most situations or, you know, having so many siblings kind of makes it so your experience is a lot different. You know, I think I was on a plane for the first time when I was like 13, and I don't know. I used to have more of a chip on my shoulder in terms of like, fuck you, everything I have, I've earned. And now it's like, well, yeah, that's still true. But at the end of the day, I'm also a straight white male. Like once you overcome certain struggles or whatever, it's like now I kind of have it easy. I can go into any meeting and people are going to take me seriously,
right?
And so that has like really kind of changed the way that I change my worldview and stuff as well.
Did you check your privilege?
No, it, you know, it's this sounds like I'm like, oh, really fucking uptight about that sort of stuff, and that's not to say that at all,
right?
But like, but I did, particularly with, like, there's a lot of, like, shit going on with police violence, with all kinds of stuff.
For sure.
And I had an experience that really, once I thought about it, like, really kind of made me think and consider just issues that hadn't affected me as much. Whereas, like, I was at a friend's concert at, like, you know, I leave this concert at like 12:30, 1 a.m. I'm drunk. I have a hoodie on because it's in the winter time. And there's a street. Colfax is like a main street in Denver. It's really obnoxious to cross. The lights always take forever to cross. So I get to the street at, you know, 1 a.m., like all bundled up, looking really sketchy. And I'm drunk, and it's not a great neighborhood, the part I'm in. And there, and I'm like, I see the little hand flashing. So I just sprint to like get across the street so I'm not going to have to wait 5 more minutes. And realize that like the person who was crossing in front of me, I just like literally sprinted full up on a cop from his blind side late at night, looking right. sketchy as fuck, drunk, all of this. And not a single thing happened, as not a single thing should have, but just kind of like looks and turns and that's it. And I was like, the next day when I was thinking about it, I was like, oh, that could have been like, that could have been a really, really, really bad situation. Mm. And I didn't have to really worry about that. And that could easily end up, if I was black or if I was Hispanic or if I just looked different or, you know, whatever. It's like, that could have been a situation where I was dead. Mm. And it's not even, that's not even like a, that shouldn't be. But that's the case.
I'll tell you this. In New Jersey, whenever I got pulled over when I was a teenager, I got a ticket. In Louisiana, every single time I got pulled over, no ticket. White yeah. privilege for you, you know?
Yeah. And it's you know, it's not to say, like, you can't make jokes about stuff. Right, you know, right. I never, ever would want to be a censor or, you know, I don't get my feelings hurt. I'm not that uptight about stuff. But even just like something like that, where it's like a really kind of minor thing, but realizing like, okay, yeah, maybe just, everyone else isn't like fucking complaining or whining. Like maybe
there's actual problems. Like when they go to apply for a job, like there's problems. Yeah. Like there's actual hurdles that other people yeah. have.
And just like having had some like hurdles that I've overcome of my own, being like, oh, that's bullshit. You know, if you work hard and you do this, like, you can do whatever. And it's like, yeah. I don't know, just reconsidering that and making an effort to see other people's points.
There's all these graphs that I've been looking at about, like, the America and where the wealth was distributed among the classes. And just, it has shrunk. It is harder. Yeah. Now the top 1% have, like, 60% of everything. Do they need to eat? I was saying, it's like, if you're at a buffet, you know, and you know that somebody cooked, like, you should make sure that everyone had their first before you go back for seconds, right? So, like, some people are just like, I want 10, I want 11, I want 40, I want 96 meals before anyone gets their first.
Oh, so yeah.
They're just a sociopath.
Well, and it's funny because, like, I grew up in a conservative area, and I was always on the more, like, liberal side of that or whatever, but, like, I went to business school. You know, I studied finance. I work in finance. Mm-hmm. And it's fucking insane. Like, just these, you know, everyone around you is, like, has this idea. And it's, like, people really believe, like, nope, the most moral, like, greed really is the best motivator. And, you know, that's going to be the best thing is, like, it's yeah. the most moral thing is to act in your own self-interest. And, like, there are fucking, like, sociopaths, you know, on Wall Street. There are a lot of them. Like,
yeah, what if, like, David Miscavige, who's, like, the head of Scientology, like, ran a bank, okay? That's, like, the psychological profile that's real. Like,
I've spent time, like, I've been on trading floors and stuff. It's, yeah. like, there's a type, and it's usually male and relatively young, but it's like, you know, there's 65,000 employees at my bank, and out of we're one of the good ones. I mean, it's not one that's doing all this shady stuff, but it's like there's a relatively small percentage of those people who actually can do any of this evil or fucked up stuff. I mean, it's really like it's a small percentage of people. The vast majority of people in the financial sector are just normal people doing their thing. But the profile of that type of person, these traders, the people who want to go, their only goal in life is to go manage their own hedge fund so they can make $1 billion. I know those people. I've spent a lot of time with those people, and there are some fucking sociopaths in there.
Yeah.
And like, just knowing like that industry, and it's like, it's really fucked up that like Bernie Sanders, for instance, he's the big boogie, the socialist boogeyman. And it's like, you know what he's saying is would have been very, very moderate views 50 years ago, 70 years ago. And now it's like the idea that, you know, maybe profit isn't the end all be all. And that maybe if you're doing like, maybe if America's doing so great, everyone in America should be doing good.
Right.
Like those types of ideas are so vilified. And it's like, for some reason, there's this like climate on Wall Street and like big corporations and everything that it's like profit bottom line is the only thing that matters and fuck everything else. Well, and I cannot understand that.
It, you know, also I just think that like the game is so rigged right now because we had this guy Obama and it's like he is the, you know, the only child of like a very a single mom, you know, like a poor woman, you know, and then like what does he want to do, like drone murder, like every, okay, so basically what I'm saying is that's proof that it's all fucked and like either he's a robot or a clone or he has a chip in his head, but like that's not a guy whatsoever who's has his own ideas, who like came up by his own bootstraps. Like he is a public relations department of the military industrial complex, you know? So it's like, is anybody saying that, you know, like college debt should be paid for by the government? Is anybody saying anything that makes any sense? You know, when you go to college and you bust your ass, you are living poor. You are working two jobs on the side, like the college loans on top of all the struggle, you know, and then you get the degree and then there's no jobs for you. It's like,
oh, that's literally the only reason I'm still working, doing the stuff I'm doing. Like if I didn't have student loans and stuff, which I'm fine with, you know, for me, it was fine. Right. I paid for college myself because I have so many siblings, all of that. So I'm okay with where I'm at. But if I didn't have that, if like tuition for college hadn't skyrocketed, well, like it's increased to an insane amount. And, you know, baby boomers who are like, well, why don't you just work, get a side job and work? And it's like, well, you paid what, $2,000 a semester in the 70s? Guess what? It's fucking $30,000 a semester now. Like, if I didn't have student loans, I would not be doing what I'm doing. I'm like right now, I don't want it to sound drastic, but it's like sort of like an economic slave, not, and that sounds ridiculous. I have a good life, whatever. But like, I have to be still in the system. I still have to be plugged into the system and have my job so that I can afford my loans, so I can afford all that sort of stuff. Whereas, you know, maybe the best thing for my life would be if I just was waiting tables and working on artwork or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's not really an option for me because I have, if I want to ever be able to buy a house or do this or do that, and I'm not even like, I'm not even super interested in like traditional life milestones, but even to just participate in society, it's like,
yeah, you gotta pay your
debt. I have to pay all my debts, which is fine. I'm, you know,
right, right.
Those were debts that I took on, but it was also because, you know, you have to go to college to have like.
But then, like, I can't understand like anyone who's done it wouldn't be just like look at everybody else with empathy and be like, you know what? Yeah, all student loans should just be jubileed 1 year, and the whole system should be. Because, like, a month of Iraq would pay for everyone's college education.
Yeah, that's, well,
that
that's
is so fucked that anyone who comes in and is, like, a real president looks at that, they'd be like, okay, well, day one, I'm going to fix this. Day two, I'm going to, you know what I mean? is anyone looking at, you know, and it does seem like Bernie Sanders is the only one who's kind of saying that stuff, but who knows if he's not compromised, you know, who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. I just find it, I find it so interesting and also just so frustrating, like, really the political system and just a lot of the systems in the United States. There's this whole idea in lip service to freedom, but how are you really free when you're a debtor and you're locked into all of these? I don't know. That's I'm not explaining it very well, but like, I think it's funny because now that I'm just trying to unplug myself from that type of thing as much as possible, it's like I'm about 30 times freer than someone, you know, than a stereotypical, like, let's say a Texas Republican or something, for instance. Mm-hmm. It's like, how free are you really when you've got, like, you're locked into your mortgage, you've got your student loans, you've got your $50,000 truck that you're paying off, and, oh, awesome, you can have guns and stuff, but it's like, that's not real, like, economic free, that... Economic freedom is just as important as social freedom. And when you're like bought into this idea of consumerist society and it's like you just have to do this, you know, you gotta buy the new TV and gotta buy the new truck and this and that, it's like once you're locked into that, there's not a lot of options you really have. Right. Like you can you can change where you're going to work, you know, you can get a new job or you can move, but it's that sort of thing is very difficult to do. There's not the freedom that we had in this country where you could move across the country and start a new life and, you know, join the gold rush and, you know, get your 40 acres and a mule or that sort of thing. There's not that type of real actual freedom anymore. If you have to go to college to get a job and you have to have a job to live, because, you know, you can't live on minimum wage. You can't raise a family on that.
Mm-hmm.
If you have to have all of this stuff to even, like, participate in society, and a big part of that is just buying more and working more, and you're working 60 hours a week and not taking vacations and that sort of stuff, that's, like... That's not freedom in any meaningful sense.
Right. It's almost like the slave master in the cotton field has just been replaced with, like, passive-aggressive numbers. It's like, no, you have to keep working because you owe this 0.8 interest at this level of this loan, you know?
Yeah, what's crazy, too, is it's we have it better than a lot of people. We're not working in a factory 16 hours a day or whatever. But, like, I have a sister who lives in Switzerland. And, you know, you would hear, like, oh, they've got really high taxes. Which they do. They have higher taxes and stuff. But she also has, like, 7 weeks of vacation a year. When she had her daughters, she took a year of, like, maternity leave. You know, there's stuff where it's, like... They actually care about work-life balance. And, yeah, like, here there's just this weird, like, you're so driven for, you've got to get a raise, you've got to work hard to do this so you can afford more. And to me, it's just like, why is...
What's the point of it all?
Yeah, I understand, for an economy, I understand why capitalism and a consumer culture is, like, good for GDP and your economy, but is that the only consideration we should have? Like, and like you were saying with the wealth inequality and stuff, is it's like you would think that as things get better and better, you know, there's more technology, there's, you know, we don't have to do backbreaking labor, you know, to just get food. Now there's machines that can grow food, mm-hmm, in a more efficient way and stuff. Right. That with all of this stuff getting better, you would think that just in the similar general proportions, it would get better for everyone. But while the, you know, the lower class has air conditioning now, and maybe they have a car where they didn't have a car 40 years ago, when the, like, the vast, vast bulk of all new wealth is going to the top, it's like, that means that things are getting worse for those at the bottom. You know? Granted, we have stuff we didn't have back then, but when you're actually comparing it,
when any president becomes the new president, and they don't go, yeah, we've been systematically making it worse for you as part of an evil plan to take all your resources for the top four people. Anyway, like, anyone who just doesn't say that is a fucking liar and a part of the fucking system.
Well, it's,
and it might as well be a robot who was made in a laboratory.
Yeah, it's really funny too, because like, there's also this whole shift, like, with I don't know, I'm really interested in like Silicon Valley and like software companies and that sort of stuff. That's just something that's interesting to me. But what's really funny is like, now the largest cab company in the world doesn't own any cars and doesn't really have any employees.
Yeah.
Like, Uber is worth like $50 billion, and that's very, very, very concentrated. It's right. Like, literally, they're the Airbnb, the biggest hotel chain in the world, for all intents and purposes, doesn't own any property.
They don't clean one dish.
Yeah, or have more than a few hundred employees.
Right.
And it's just like, there's this whole weird, like, because everything can scale now, like with the internet, with the global economy becoming, you know, the world getting kind of smaller in that regard, now that stuff can really scale in all these ways, instead of having, you know, each town having their grocer who had a good grocery store who was doing well, instead it's just scaled so that's Kroger and Safeway and Costco and Sam's Club. And that's all well and good, but when it's like, when all of this wealth and all of this new shift in the economy, you know, all these software companies and stuff, they're making it so that engineers and owners are really highly compensated, but like no one else necessarily is. It's just like this concentration. I'm not saying it's necessarily a specific plot in mind or anything like that, but to me, that's where the government needs to adjust to still keep things relatively, to try and keep things still good for all of the citizens.
Mm. America's got to be has the best comics in the world, you know, over and over again, you know. So it is weird that the people that, you know, it just gives everybody a chip on their shoulder where they have to go out like 5 times a week, because that's what it takes. Like, you kind of have to be crazy to be the best at anything, you know. And it's like, the system makes you fucking crazy. It just frustrates you to a level where you just got to put all your chips in at one point, you know?
Yeah. See, that's, I find that interesting, because I don't know, I guess I don't have as much of like a problem with that, because that's, to me, that's someone who wants to do it. Like, if you want to be the best and you have to work a ton or work really hard for it, even if it's like kind of a crazy level where it's like you're going out 5-6 nights a week doing open mics, doing as many showcases as you can, whatever. I guess for me, it's like, as long as that's something that you can choose, like, I don't know, I don't mind it, or I don't have a problem with that kind of like American focus on excellence, or gotta be the best and you'll get there by working really hard. I guess where I have a problem is where it's like, where you just don't really have the option.
Right.
Yeah, like for your job or whatever. Because right. like
you don't have the option to.
Yeah, there's the expectation. I mean, there's plenty of workplaces where you have vacation days, but the expectation is that either you don't use them or you only use them during the downtime, mm-hmm. of the, like when your company isn't busy. Or, you know, you have to use them during the week between Christmas and New Year's, or like when there's not an option, or, oh, you want to have like an okay life and kids and a house, well, you've got to do this. You have to go to college and you have to do work 50 hours a week and you have to put up with a lot of bullshit and whatever. That's when I have a problem. But yeah. Like, I don't know. I mean, I have a work ethic and I have focus and stuff. I just hate when I have to use that for pointless shit as opposed to what I want to do.
Or like making other people rich.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And that's a whole thing too, is it's like, for me, one thing I'm kind of worried about is just like, let's say, cause I'm really interested in kind of like futurology and like I'm into technology and I like to keep up with that type of stuff. And it's like, let's say things go the way that they're kind of headed, you know? All these companies are working on self-driving cars, for instance. So awesome. Let's say 30 years from now, we just have that locked in. You know, if you want to drive, you can, but there's self-driving cars. You don't even need to own one because there's Google or Uber or whoever. So, okay, awesome. And let's say that, you know, we continue to do well with manufacturing, and let's say 3D printing gets really, really good. Like, what is going to happen with all of our workforce? Because we're moving more and more and more towards making human labor obsolete, or at least making it so that unless you're doing, like, specific creative or mental type labor, if you're, you know, if you're an accountant or...
Then it's just like 300 rich inbred people who are having their every need serviced by a robot.
But let's say that we can have a robot and AI. Let's say we have a robot with AI who can pretty much do anyone's job better than them. And they're cheap enough that we don't need restaurant workers. We don't need this. We don't need that. Where does that end up? Because the way things are going, I don't know what's... Is it just the top 5% who are making use of this and everyone else is just kind of fucked and out of work? Or what, like, I'm very curious as to what our society looks like, because I think this whole, like, runaway greed or this extreme individualism in this, like, literally socialism is a dirty word. When if you actually look at it, it's like just... social costs, you know, working on social stuff as well. But it's like we have such an extreme individual spirit and like kind of culture. I'm kind of afraid of where that ends up. Like, what happens if you're the guy who can buy a robot and then you have your robot make more robots and all of a sudden you don't need any employees for your business and you're killing it, making tons of money and stuff, but
also like when you get to the level of like neural implants, like you get like a memory chip in your thing to make your brain memory storage, like so that you can, you know, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's scary. And we have to look at like, see, I think that like the biodiversity of like the human workforce is where like our ingenuity has come from in the past, you know, and they've justified their existence by being, you know, new engineers with a new, you know, that push it further along. But yeah, it's like if you engineer your replacement that can engineer its own brain faster. Yeah.
You know? And I mean, I can see a version of like, where we're in this utopia and everyone works 6 hours a week and, you know, you get to just spend your time with leisure and stuff. Like, I feel like that is like a possibility, but I'm just really like,
do you want that utopia pod to be only filled with sociopaths?
that's what I'm concerned is it's like, what happens? You know, I feel like in America, there's this whole idea that, you know, American exceptionalism, we're the best country there's ever been, you know, we're the best in the world. Like that type of shit's just like taught in schools. Like I personally think the Pledge of Allegiance is kind of creepy. You know, if you like just switch a 6-year-old American saying that shit to a 6-year-old German saying the Reich is the best Reich. And not to, I don't mean to go heavy on like the Nazi illusions, but it's like, there's this whole like, there's a lot of kind of propaganda, like America's the greatest.
That's
all
also
this.
Just objectively not true, because if you look at if you your scale is like the standard of living, like it's,
happiness, education, like really places like Finland or Canada or like there's a lot of places that have better that are better than us in a wide variety of ways. If you're just looking at world rankings of stuff. And so it's like, I think there's this idea, particularly from the from the elite in American society and stuff, that things are just always going to go this way. And I'm like, I honestly am, I'm sort of, I feel like there's such a disconnect between the majority of people and like the people who are in charge and who have all the power. It's like, I could see there being a revolution, you know? It's like, there's our political system is so polarized and there's so much kind of just like hate that it's like, I could really see there being, you know, a revolution or there being something like a company just, or a state wanting to secede or, you know, like, I guess I...
Yeah, if you have all these college-educated people that are real smart enough to know exactly how fucked they are, they're pissed, you know?
Yeah.
And you got them brought up on a certain level of living, and then all of a sudden it's like there's another Wall Street crash or Great Depression, and then, like, the number machine ain't printing those, like, food coupons anymore.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And, like, all of a sudden it's anarchy.
And I think we, like, I think we've seen, like, elements of that, you know? Like, we see that there's a lot of unrest. You know, the Occupy Wall Street stuff didn't end up doing a ton, also because there wasn't a leader, there weren't central goals.
But also, do you know what the police have for protesters these days? Literally, police right now, if you're protesting, can shoot a microwave at people's brains that makes them lethargic and not want to do anything anymore.
Hmm.
Huh? So the police are shooting microwaves at people's brains who are protesting? You know, it's like, that's how fucking scared they are these days. That, you know, they're like, no, I'm the sociopath and the super pod, so...
And there's
anyone that gets uppity, shoot a fucking microwave in their brain? What are you fucking talking about? Like, all those people should be killed. Like, if you're a fucking police officer who thinks that it's cool to shoot a microwave brain at fucking protesters' brains, you should be... That's a Nuremberg trial shit. You can't do that. You can't do that, you know?
Yeah, well, you know what's really funny for me is, like, I stay, like, the internet is kind of like my, I would consider myself a citizen of the internet before a citizen of, like, America, for instance.
Right.
I teach myself stuff, like, that's been the best thing. I'm one of those people where it's like, the internet's the greatest thing that's ever happened to me.
Yeah.
And I know, I know quite a bit about the technology behind it. And it's like, we live in like a fucking insane surveillance state. Like especially when you just combine a couple different things, like for instance, did you know that like the police, as they're driving around, they're just taking pictures of everyone's license plates. And so all that stuff just gets stored, which, you know, people, that doesn't sound so horrible. Like, oh, okay. Yeah, they probably find stolen cars that way, or, you know, that way they can see if someone's got a warrant or whatever. But they keep that data. That data just stays there. So now they have, you know, a pretty easy way to track your whereabouts. That doesn't need a warrant. That doesn't need a subpoena to have that information, because the police already have it on their servers. Then if you look at a technology company, I don't have it on me, but, like, if you have an iPhone, I could show you in your settings, buried pretty deep in virtual, anyone I've ever showed it is freaked out and doesn't realize it. I mean, they have your time stamped locations.
Oh yeah.
And they keep that, like, Google does the same thing. Google has it, except that Google keeps your time stamped locations. If you opt out of it, but they make it very difficult to do and the public doesn't think about it. Google has them from whenever you got your first Google like Android device. So if you have 8 years, if you've had 8 Android phones in a row, or, you know, 8 years worth, they will have 8 years worth of your time stamped locations on there. And now police fortunately still have to have a warrant for it, but police can access that data. So literally you could, 3 years later, they're trying to ascertain your whereabouts, they can subpoena and find that data. They can cross-reference it with all of the license plate data. They can cross-reference all of that with your phone calls, mm-hmm. you know, which, you know, like all of the stuff that the NSA was doing, the PRISM program, all of that. They now have a record. They don't have the content of your phone calls, but they have all of the data around it. They have the length, what number you're calling. They're accessing your email. They're accessing your text messages. It's like you can put together a really terrifying profile on someone very easily.
Right.
And Americans are just kind of like cool with that. In the government, like last night, I was watching the Democratic debate, and Hillary Clinton was calling for more power along that. You know, they're making encryption into this like boogeyman of terrorists. We're using encrypted communication. And it's like, encryption is what keeps like everyone safe. Like, and they're trying to make it so the government can have a backdoor into the encryption. They're like, we got to make it so Google and Apple don't see us as the enemy, but we collaborate together. And I'm just like, there's this insane surveillance state that is currently happening, and people just don't care or don't know about it or whatever. And I'm like, how are these people so fucking concerned with the Second Amendment? Like, everyone, all these gun control people are like, Second Amendment, we need to have our assault rifles and our fucking high-capacity magazines. And for me, I'm just like, what about, like, the Fifth Amendment, you know, warrantless search and seizure? Because mm-hmm. that shit is basically eroded completely.
Or the Fourth Amendment, to face your accuser.
Yeah.
It's like, when your accuser is a bunch of robots, you know, it's like, yeah, log in to complain. Until then, you're in Guantanamo with no warrant, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, like, kind of shifting gears or whatever, but it's like drone strikes. Like, right. The President Obama has order the killing of U.S. citizens using drone strikes. Like, that shit is, like, habeas corpus is from the fucking 1400s. Like, this is...
You can just use robots to murder anybody, and you have your iPhone in your pocket, so, boom.
Yeah, these things are, like, should be terrifying.
And, like, what if they just, like, unleash a swarm of them? They're just making a swarm of them, and then one day they're just like, everybody who is this politics. Go, my monkeys, go!
No one wants to think about it. And it's like, you know, I don't... That's not what makes me afraid or whatever, necessarily. Right.
Our town, we're killing it.
that's not the thing that makes me afraid, mm-hmm. but that's possible. Like, from a techno, like, people be like, oh, you're being ridiculous. From a technological standpoint, if our government wanted to, they could now pretty much, I mean, unless you're taking extraordinary security measures, they could pretty much just take you out at any time.
Yeah.
They can turn on your fucking webcam on your computer and just be watching you.
Right.
Like, that is all technologically possible, and like the NSA and the Department of Defense, they're all working to make that even more possible.
And it's like, why would you want all those powers if you weren't a huge creep? If you are a huge creep, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Well, so then we got to really watch out for, like, who the fuck gets in the government, you know?
Right. And that's it. When we only have, like, 30% of people vote in elections, and so many people vote, like, outside of their own best interests, like, whatever politics you actually believe in, mm-hmm. like, the fact is that Democrats are better for poor people and Republicans are better for rich people. And the fact that, like, Republicans have managed to continued people voting against their best interest for years and years and years, like, and it's, oh, well, it's Mexicans who are taking our jobs, so we better hate them. And it's just like, well, you shouldn't be vote, like, if you're a poor white guy and you're concerned that your job's getting taken away or whatever, voting Republican's not the way to fix that.
Mm.
Like, you can have that ideal, you can believe that politically, but, like, you're voting against your best interests. And they've, like, they've somehow managed to keep poor white people voting for them for decades when it's like
on the grounds of homophobia.
Yeah, because or they're trying to attack your marriage, or, you know, the Muslims are coming, or, and I'm just like, what?
Yeah, it just, when I see Fox News, I just think of the board meeting of going like how dumb people are, how we can, like, okay, this is the profile of an American's brain. Now we have to make them fear, consume, and regret.
Oh, here's how we do it. Well, and it's funny because now, like, the presidential whole thing is now being kind of shifted onto this whole defense, you know, like the Paris bombings, the San Bernardino shooting. Which, by the way, the San Bernardino shooting, they said that those two people pledged their allegiance to ISIS, all this sort of stuff. They've had to backtrack on that because none of the shit that the media, that the report said and the media was saying, right, actually turned out to be true. But they're still, they were even in the Democratic debate last night, still trying to treat it as if now that we've been attacked by radicalized ISIS, yeah, on American soil.
Well, the thing,
it's like, those were two fucking lone wolves who, like,
ISIS was invented by the CIA anyway. So when they say it, they're just going, you know, that boogeyman that we invented, you know, in the CIA boardroom, that's not real.
Who's holding all, well,
it's really Santa Claus for terrorism, ISIS. It's not real. It's a boogeyman. And it's, they're trying to turn, you know, like, anyone who does anything, they can blame on ISIS for their own benefit. You know, so it's just this constant, like, tragedy machine that they can use to enact radical laws that are reactionary to events that they create.
Yes.
Politics. We've been going off.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's good to catch up with you, Mr. Jack Mudd.
Yeah, you too, Eric.
This has been another episode of Highway Motherfucking Diaries. I'm on my way to Roast Battle in Los Angeles, Tuesday, December 29th. This will come out after that's already happened, when I get back to New Orleans. So probably the first Tuesday in January, this will hit. Anyway, that's another, do you have anything you want to plug or anything?
No, I'm good.
Okay. That's another episode of Highway Diary in the motherfucking bag. Later.